I would like to welcome you and bring you greetings in the absence of Dean James Hudnut Blumler. And I would like to also welcome you to our first community breakfast of the spring semester. Today, our lecture will come from Graham Reside, who is the Executive Director of the Cal Turner Program in Moral Leadership for the Professions and also Assistant Professor of Divinity. This year, 21 students from the Owen Graduate School of Management and the Vanderbilt Divinity School traveled with 3 faculty members to India for a 10-day study of poverty. For 7 weeks in the spring of the 2007 semester, 50-plus students enrolled in the course Project Pyramid, Business Applications and Innovations of Alleviating Poverty. The course was taught by Professor Bart Victor and Graham Reside, and it focused on new trends in poverty alleviation. Please join me in welcoming Graham Reside as he and students from the Divinity School reflect on Project Pyramid, Religion and the Business of Alleviating Poverty.
Good morning. Just to be clear, this is not a seminar on business opportunities, right? So, you didn't get up early to learn how to invest in India. But I do want to share with you a little bit about Project Pyramid, and then I've asked some of the students from the class to share with you also their experiences. The first thing that I would want you to know about Project Pyramid is that it's really a student-initiated project, and the faculty and the administration is really trying to get on board and follow the enthusiasm that we have been getting from students around this issue. I'm certainly not trained as an economist in business. I can't balance my own checkbook. I have no real skill in this area, so I'm learning from the students more than they're learning from me, certainly. And then Bart Victor in the business school, who is the Turner professor in the business school, is also helping lead that project. So these students came up with this idea, right, that they were interested in thinking about alleviating poverty and using some new and creative ways to do it. And business students particularly were sort of out on the edge on this and leading it, and were interested and moved by, I think, 2 things, and some of the business students could speak to this better than I can. But one is Muhammad Yunus, right, whose program in microfinancing was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. This is a pretty interesting dynamic, actually, because the Grameen Bank, which Muhammad Yunus founded, is a for-profit bank. So a for-profit bank won the Nobel Peace Prize. And so this, I think, it indicates a sort of shift in the way that we're thinking about alleviating poverty or addressing questions of poverty. And then the second impetus is a book by a professor in business, Prahalad, named Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. And I think we sort of stole at least the notion of the Project Pyramid from that book. But think about that, Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. That was the name of the book. And his observation was that we have, in the world, there are 4 billion people living on less than $1,500 a year. But those people don't need to be excluded from our business enterprises, but in fact represent a kind of market. So you might imagine that some of our Divinity students chafed at that notion a little bit, but we're learning what that means for him, and it's much more complicated than it might seem at first. So those 2 things, I think, in some ways shaped the interest around this question of alleviating poverty. But there is a sort of sea change in the ways in which people are thinking about poverty and development work. So, you know, Bill Gates, the Google Foundation, there's a lot of new and innovative ways that are being experimented with for alleviating poverty. I think under all of that is the assumption that the old ways have not been as successful as we might have hoped. So the business students are eager to explore those new ways. So last year, the business students approached Cal Turner and said, would you be willing to support some of this work? Cal said, yes, I would, but I'd like you to include the Divinity School. So we got a phone call and said, is there anybody over there who might be interested in being involved in this? So I met with Bart Victor, and we decided, well, let's have 5 slots in your class for students from this progressive left-wing Divinity School who might want to go over to the business school. And we had 20-some students in the class. So it was quite, to me, remarkable that all these Divinity students, we had thought maybe 5 would be interested, but we had over 20 who took the class in the business school. And then of those 20, 5 went on the trip to India. We took students to India in part to explore what's going on the ground in India, particularly around microfinancing, but around other things as well. So this morning what I want to do is just share with you some of the things that I have learned in my time in this program, and then to invite some of our students, 5 of our students, to come and share some of the things they've learned. And I've invited 4 Divinity students and 1 business student to lead that conversation. I'm hoping we'll have some time at the end. But really, from my perspective, the point of this breakfast was to talk about what it's like for Divinity folks to be over in the business school, right? And what it's like for us to engage this question in new ways. I should say one other thing about the Divinity School. I think that this Project Pyramid has had a kind of viral effect in the Divinity School, at least insofar as the students' interest has pushed beyond just this one class. And really, Doug Meeks offered a course last fall in direct response to student interest around addressing issues of poverty. And I think some of our students who are in that class might be able to speak to that as well. So I think that faculty are paying a little more attention to the question of poverty and thinking more in a more friendly way about how we can partner with business folks to address that. Okay, so one thing I would say is there's a clash of culture when we go over to the business school. I can speak from my own perspective, but in general, I view globalization as a problem, right? And I view businesses as the greatest threat to our freedom, right? That's my bias. I think corporations are a big problem. We go over to the business school, and globalization is an opportunity, right? And businesses provide freedom and new ways of being in the world for people. So that right there is a kind of fundamental conflict that I experience every time I go over to the business school. The second thing is language. We use language very differently. Exploitation, for example, we consider a bad word over here. But in the business school, exploitation has a different meaning. You want to exploit in order to maximize profits, for example. But I've also learned that it's just too facile a reading of business that I have. It's too facile a reading of globalization. And I've been greatly impressed by the sort of religious fervor that business students have and the enthusiasm and optimism they have about the world and about possibilities. So let me just share some slides with you to talk. That's something else. If you ask a business faculty, what did you talk about? They say, I'll send you my slides. So slides go to the very heart of business school, so I'm trying to adopt part of the culture here. This is a image that represents the world, poverty in the world, and we can see and where we get the notion of the pyramid. So at the top, 75 to 100 million people live on more than $20,000 a year. Okay. The second tier is 1,500 to 20,000. But the third tier, which represents two-thirds of the world's population, lives on $1,500 a year or less. Okay. I have some data on my PowerPoint. Can you all hear me?
Yes. Okay, of that, I can't see it, but of that, I should have done that.
Of this 4 million, half the world's population lives on a dollar a day or less. Right? Half the world's population lives on a dollar a day or less. So this is a real issue, and this is not this is purchase power parity. This is not American dollars. This is what they actually live on, right? So it's not like okay, but $1,500 is a lot of money in India. No, it's a translated figure. Right? So this is what they actually have to get by on. It would be like we're trying to get by at $1,500. Okay, this is a map that lays out around the world where people, the percentages of people living on a dollar a day or less, okay? So I'm not sure if you can see this, I'll come around and point it out. The dark green says 2 to 5% of the population is living on a dollar a day or less, not 100%. Gray means nobody, right? 5 to 20% is in the green, right? So much of South America, parts of Africa, Asia. 5 to 20% are living on $1 a day or less. The yellow is 20 to 40%. So, Indian subcontinent, parts of Africa again, Mongolia. So, 20 to 40% living on $1 a day or less. And the red and orange, this is pretty extreme, where you have 40 to 60 and 60 to 80% of the population living on $1 a day or less. Oops. How do I make that go away, Nick?
Keep over there. Yeah. Just about enough. To the right.
Yeah. Just make it good. Thank you. Well, one of the things we've learned that I found most helpful is that poverty is not as is not simple. It's much more complex than even those figures that I just gave you represent. And Amartya Sen, who is another Nobel Prize laureate in economics, he won the prize in, I believe, welfare economics, I think in 1998. He provides a much more complex notion of poverty, and I think it's one that our divinity students can really resonate with. And it's the notion that poverty is about the conditions of our life, right? And how free are we, actually, to flourish as human beings? So it's not just money that establishes that. So in that sense, you could be a poor African-American, say, in Nashville, right, who makes more than a dollar a day, but is more impoverished, according to Sen, than somebody in India who may make less than a dollar a day, because of all the other dimensions of poverty, right? So he this quote is from him: "Poverty is a human condition characterized by the sustained or chronic deprivation of the resources, capabilities, choices, security, and power necessary for the enjoyment of an adequate standard of living and other civic, cultural, economic, political, and social rights." Again, I hope you can see how our divinity students can really sort of get into that notion of poverty as a part of the human condition and be invested in addressing those issues. So. Nick, what do I do?
Just
one click. I'm a Mac guy. Hey, okay. Okay, so this is one of the facts that really challenged my own assumptions about globalization and about business, and that is that we can see that there has actually been a marked decline in poverty around the world, and my business colleagues remind me that this decline goes along with the increase in globalization, that there is a correlation between the decline in poverty worldwide and the expansion of globalization and the expansion of markets. Okay, so the worldwide one is this black one,
this black line with the square, right? We can see the East Asian is the most marked decline in poverty. Okay, there are some flat ones, and sub-Saharan Africa actually is going up a little bit.
And there are a lot of complicated reasons for that, not least of which is the HIV and AIDS epidemic, which is challenging. But that I point out this slide to share with you what I've learned about globalization. And however complicated it is, one of the things we have to say is globalization has been a contributor in the decline of poverty. This goes to Sen's point that poverty is a complicated thing, but it does map closely, if not exactly, to life expectancy. The poorer you are, the shorter your life expectancy, right? And for a variety of reasons. But again, you can see the general trajectory is upwards over the last 25, 55 years, with the exception of sub-Saharan Africa. This is the long view. This is the long view. And we can see that this idea of growing our economies is a modern idea or a modern reality. And I point out this slide for a couple of reasons. That for most of human history, poverty was a part of the furniture of the world. It was just part of, it had to be, it was just with you. There wasn't a lot you could do about it other than to ameliorate. So, but we see a radical change. Now we can see, you can actually get out of poverty. You could set up a social system where there is no poverty. It's called Denmark. Okay? But I do wonder, so I hold up this slide because religious folks often, one of our sources is the scriptures. But that in the biblical world, poverty was, I would suggest, was more of a part of the fabric of reality than we think about it today, than certainly the business school thinks about it today. I mean, one of the surprising things to us was the business students, they're like, here's a problem, let's fix it. Poverty's a problem, let's take care of it. And in fact, they have the idea of, let's get rid of this in our lifetime. Now, to me, that's, I have a strong doctrine of sin, that's hubris. But... there is some data to suggest that they're not completely, utopian in their thinking. Okay. Oh, shit. This is just one slide that I think is interesting to talk about the expansion of globalization. One way in which we are all connected. And I'm not sure if you can read this, but this is the proportion of the world population with telephone subscriptions, personal computers, and internet connections. And just from 1990 to 2004, we can see that mobile phone use, for example, went from here to almost 30% of the world's population has a mobile phone. I just got mine. But the fixed phone line is a little flattened out, but some countries are skipping right over fixed lines, going straight to mobile technologies. And then where's the internet user? We can also see a rather spike in the internet, in the use of internet computers. I guess the last thing I want to say before I invite our students to come up and share some things with you is that for the business folks that I've talked to, inviting people into the global marketplace is a way of including, right? They see this effort, this fear of business and this fear of globalization as a way of keeping people outside. It's a form of exclusion. And that was a really interesting shift for me to think about. If you really want to help people, you have to get their first foot on the rung of the ladder. And unfortunately, maybe unfortunately, that's a value judgment. But there's only one ladder, right? It's a global economy, and people, when they get on it, they can improve their lives. That's the assumption that's going on in this class project pyramid. It's a challenge to a lot of my own assumptions, but it's been interesting to think about. And I hope we have a chance to talk about it. I'd be interested to know what you think about it. There are some downsides, obviously, that we talk about in class. There is the very real problem of the dissolution and destruction of cultures, local cultures, right? Once you become part of a global economy, it's hard to sustain your local culture. But there is also the fact that people are enthusiastic. A lot of folks are enthusiastic to get on board. They want to see their lives improve. They want more resources made available to them. And it may be that they're willing to sacrifice some of their own culture. But it is something that is sad for other people to think that these local cultures are being watered down, attenuated, even destroyed. Okay, so that's my little piece for this morning. I'd like to invite the students up to share their experiences. I've asked them to share their experiences around a range of things, but not least of which is the trip. So we went on a trip to India last year, and the second piece is share how they felt about engaging business students. And I did ask Asif to come, because he's a business student, to share a little bit from the other side of things. So could you guys come on up now? This is Diane Ferris, Asif Muhammad, Chandra Payne / Allen, got married over Christmas, Clarissa O, and Lindsay Hammond. Thank you.
I'll love it.
While we're talking, we'll put up a slideshow in the background of our trip to India so you can get a visual to go with it. I want to talk first a little bit about Divinity and Business School collaboration and how it felt to work together. Before I came to Divinity School, I was studying international relations, and one of our classic texts is called The Clash of Civilizations. So luckily, it was not a clash, total clash of civilizations. But as Graham mentioned, there were a lot of initial strange things to get used to, like language. I remember when we had our first meeting to learn about this possible class in the business school, and they were talking about mods instead of semesters, and instead of assignments, they had work deliverables. I was like, what is a work deliverable? We started asking about what the workload of this class would be like, and they didn't have any 15-page papers or, 10 books on their reading list like we were used to. They had, they do bullet points and PowerPoint presentations and slides. So it was just a whole different kind of approach to learning. We were pretty excited about the lack of papers and books, but there were still a lot of, it was still a lot of work. We put in a lot of effort in group projects and other forms. But we found that language really was important. Language kind of impacts the way you understand the world. It impacts the way you make connections with other people. And so we began to slowly build a common language. Bart Victor from the business school actually had a sort of remedial course for the Divinity students outside of the regular class, where we talked about some of the vocabulary and ideas like capital and things like that. And slowly we began to kind of pick up on this language, and to the point where one day I sat down to write a sermon, and I found that suddenly I was, without even thinking about it, comparing manna in the wilderness to the supply chain and talking about the four P's of marketing and explaining the relationship between God and the Israelites. So it kind of sunk in somehow. And so we learned that mostly that it's good not to make assumptions that your words carry the same meaning. And we began to really talk through some of the meanings behind words like exploit and leverage and things like Graham mentioned. So we were able to clarify our ideas on both sides of the school discipline line and be able to better express ourselves to our peers and find out what they meant when they used words like exploit. So some of the benefits of the collaboration, Graham also kind of touched on this, but there are two very different approaches in the Divinity School and the Business School. The Div students are very good at asking questions and reflecting and thinking about the impact of our actions. And the business students have this energy and creativity and enthusiasm, and they had a flyer for a program that said, we're going to end poverty in this meeting. Which we kind of laugh at, but really that kind of belief in your own agency and what you can do is contagious and something that we really needed, I think, in the Divinity School. So we really could learn from setting real, tangible goals and attacking them with the belief that we can achieve them or at least come close. But at the same time, we really feel like the Divinity School contributes a reflective piece and a relational piece in thinking about how what we're doing and achieving these goals impacts people beyond our own circle. And sometimes you need those tough questions to be asked in the midst of your actions. The Divinity School is really good at questioning the status quo and working for long-term change. And the Business School is really good at looking at what we've got and making the best of it and really using what we have in the immediate short term. So instead of working against each other in these efforts, we found that it's really been good to try to bring these together and work for both long-term and short-term change at the same time. We were able to break down a lot of stereotypes. The trip to India was really good at breaking down some of these stereotypes that we went in with. We found that most of them were only superficial. I think a lot of the business students weren't too sure what our beliefs were, if we were going to try to convert them on the trip, or if all we wanted to talk about was our faith and our religion. But we ended up having a lot of really meaningful questions. We took some long bus rides and train rides as we were going visiting sites in India. And we were somewhat surprised at the really deep questions that the business students had on issues. They wanted to talk about their spiritual journey. They wanted to talk about the death penalty and education and scripture and a whole variety of things. We had some really wonderful, meaningful conversations that broke down some of the ideas that we went in with about each other. And I think in the process of that, we learned a lot about ourselves. I know that we in the Divinity School did. On a more professional level and less personal, we found a lot of useful benefits to some of the issues that we wrestle with in our classes and at school. We were able to talk over with people from a totally different perspective. We had a great conversation about CEO salaries one day at lunch and the moral and practical implications of skyrocketing CEO salaries, things like living wage, that many of us in the Divinity School are concerned with, and of course in the Business School might have a different perspective, but it was good to exchange those perspectives and hear the other side and wrestle together. Something that I think we all agreed on in this class was that charity is not the best model, and so it was good to think about how together we can come up with something that's more sustainable, more efficient, and something that utilizes self-interest, but with a real vision for creating a better way. And all of us also hold the belief that real change in the community is going to require collaboration between institutions that are grassroots, like many churches are. Churches tend to be good, or faith groups tend to be good at holding trust from people in the community, knowing people in the community at all income levels. But businesses often bring the resources that are needed to create change. And so instead of kind of nonprofits and faith groups going to businesses and saying, you know, please give us this grant, thanks, goodbye, to really start building those relationships where we're working together and collaboratively for change in ways that strengthen long-term connections between the community and the people who have the resources. Both groups, at least the Project Pyramid groups on both disciplines, have a real goal of empowerment. This is the kind of foundation of Prahalad's model, that people at the bottom of the pyramid can be empowered as consumers. And for Divinity students, we also want to empower people who have traditionally been kind of marginalized, to use their voices. And we may have kind of different ideas about why this empowerment is important. For Divinity students, you know, it's been drilled into us that Imago Dei, everyone's created in the image of God, there's an inherent value to humanity. And at least coming out of Prahalad, from the business side, you have this idea of people have an inherent value as consumers. They can contribute to the economy. And so if we bring those together, we can really use that idea that people have value to make a real difference, and not do it in isolation, but together we can really improve the community in a more sustainable way. Now, and a little bit more specifically, Chandra is going to talk about our trip to India and what we saw and learned out of that.
Good morning.
Before I came to Divinity School, I spent a couple years after undergraduate graduation working in communities of need and trying to figure out ways to create sustainable ways to end poverty. And so one of the driving forces and passions that brought me to Divinity School was this notion about looking at poverty from a theological perspective and how to respond to that in a way that I thought informed my faith life and could inform my faith community. And so when I heard about the Project Pyramid project and concept, this seemed like a very unique way to look at poverty from another angle, from the financial side, to look at ways of innovative infrastructures that, as Diane and Graham mentioned, can bring people into the global marketplace. This was something that I never thought about before and seemed like a very necessary piece to bring this theological perspective and the practical, more business perspective together. So when we found out that there's going to be a class about Project Pyramid, as Graham mentioned, we were all very excited to look at this issue more deeply in a way that many of us had not looked at or seen before, even heard about before. So part of the class, the first 7 weeks, we spent, as Graham mentioned, talking about C.K. Prahlad's Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. We also looked at very specific ways that businesses were including people at the bottom of the pyramid, whether that was to create very cheap cell phones, to increase communication between cities and villages in the poorer nations. Also, we looked at a company that was creating a very affordable laptop to also create increased ways of communicating with one another so that people were not so isolated. So as we continued these 7 weeks, we just looked at various aspects of what was going on in this new industry of focusing on the bottom of the pyramid. And so at the end of that 7 weeks, over our spring break, several of us were privileged to go to India and to see some of this action on the ground. And this was one of the most impactful moments of the trip. And as you can see, as the videos or the pictures are streaming, several of the pictures are from when we actually went to the village, and this was one of the most important parts of the trip. We were escorted into the village with SKS Microfinance, which has been creating loans and microfinance since 1998. And so the way this works is that they seek out villages of poor communities and bring in ways to include them into the global marketplace. And this is a three sort of fold prospect. The first thing they do is they create ways to meet the basic needs first. And this is food and other support services. And the next thing they do is provide skills training for various trades, learning about credit and how the loan actually works. And the last thing they do is they grant a loan to start some type of business or enterprise that creates a sustainable income. And so SKS, their motto is empowering the poor to become economically self-reliant by providing financial services in a sustainable manner. And I thought one of the most unique things about SKS was that they seek out poor women, and that's the most marginalized group in India and almost anywhere in the world when you're looking at bottom of the pyramid. So the fact that they were looking at loaning only to poor women was very unique to me. Also, when we entered the village, that we were able to sit in on one of the group meetings. So after the village is chosen to receive loans, each village is broken up into teams of five women. And so this is sort of their responsibility group. They are responsible to each other, and they also serve as guarantors for each other. So as if I was in a group with, say, my colleagues, I would receive a loan, and I would be responsible for paying back the loan. But for some reason, if I was not able to pay the loan back, one of my colleagues would need to help me out. And so I thought that was a really unique way of creating a sense of responsibility and encouragement among one another. And you can see as we were in the group, they all sat in a circle. And this was a time where they would talk about the loans and kind of where they were in their enterprises, and they would also pay back the loan. The loans are repaid weekly. And this was a unique way to do microfinance because they're non-collateralized loans, which means you don't have to have any previous credit or any collateral to put up for the loan. And so this is one of the unique reasons why this works for these villages. And one of the other unique things is that one of the women in this group of people who receive the loan is also chosen as the group leader. So she facilitates the meeting, and as the field staff person from SKS is there, she will, as the people pay their money, she will pass it on to them. So again, it creates another level of empowerment. This is not a charity project. It's ways of creating more sustainable development, building self-esteem, really creative ways to improve the lives of individual families and whole communities. It was amazing to see the pride and the confidence that some of the women expressed over having some being able to create these enterprises. Some of the women bought oxen. One bought a cart to be able to sell aluminum dishes and pots and pans. Another was able to build a small store in which she could sell various goods, perishable goods, that so the community wouldn't have to walk long distances to get these things. And it was very neat to see how really these things were coming full circle. One of the women expressed how through her income, through her business, she was able to send her son to school, which is a very unique opportunity. And so it was just very neat to kind of walk through the village and see how these things were changing the lives of these individual women. So it was no longer anonymous stories that we were reading in C.K. Prahlad's book, but it was very individual and personal that we could see on the ground. And as we looked through the community, we could definitely see the improvement of houses, the health of the children, the health of the women themselves and the families. And here we see a payment being made to one of the people in our group who was going to pass that to the field staff. So we were able to really just get in and sit there with them and hear the meeting and see the way that things transpired. And so this was one of the ways, I think, that really brought this program and this trip and the class of that first venture for Project Pyramid full circle. And we were able to see this very integrated learning style, that after we had studied and read and talked to each other, we were able to go talk to them, how is this really impacting your lives? And so I'm really privileged to be able to share this with you and to have experienced this, and so we look forward to the questions afterwards.
Good morning. My name is Asif Shah Muhammad, and I'm a second-year MBA student, so I am the enemy, as Janet would say, or one of the exploiters. But when I came to business school, I'm originally from Bangladesh, and so when I came to business school a couple of years ago, people had just started hearing about Grameen Bank, and I was very lucky that within a couple of months of being here, Dr. Yunus from Bangladesh won the Nobel Peace Prize, and that actually gave us a lot of impetus to Project Pyramid. So what drew me to Project Pyramid? I wanted to, when I first came to business school, the bottom of the pyramid, which Graham was talking about, is not the typical target market that a business school student looks at. Most of our business school students want to work in investment banking or in consulting or some multinational firm. So when I first started talking to the students who started Project Pyramid, we had just come up with the concept that we wanted to look at a way to alleviate global poverty by the time we were done with business school. Obviously, that is not possible, but what we wanted to achieve with this organization is a way that we could provide business school students with a framework or the tools to create sustainable solutions to alleviate poverty, and in the process, we wanted to create a way to bring about collaboration with various students from all the graduate programs here at Vanderbilt. And one of the programs that responded the best to us was the Divinity School. So we have been very fortunate to have a number of Divinity School students along with us on the trip and in our classes. And it's made most of our discussions in class, it's enriched most of our discussions in class simply because when we look at any problem in our business school classes, as everyone else mentioned here before, we look at what we can do now and how we are going to resolve it immediately without having to reflect on all the other underlying issues that may be prevalent. And this is where I think the Divinity School students have been able to provide the reflection that we needed to think about, say, when we went on the India trip, to think about the socioeconomic context in India. And I want to tell you about a small impact of looking at the bottom of the pyramid. In India, the Indian division of Unilever, they were looking at the Indian market, and a small example is when we think about buying a shampoo, we look at, you know, big 1 liter or whatever bottle of shampoo, and this is what we go out and buy. And in India, the average person is not able to afford to buy this big bottle of shampoo. So Unilever looked at this particular market, and they said, okay, how can we exploit this market? And they decided to come up with these little packets of shampoo that they sell for less than 1 rupee. And that equates to less than maybe 5 cents. And this is what, and they decided to send this out or sell this in the markets. And what this has done, the average person in India is now able to actually go out, and they are buying these little packets of shampoo on a daily basis from the little corner store or the little store in their villages. And now they're able to get something which they were never able to do before, which was able to improve hygiene. And this has an immediate effect on people's health. So if you think about it, it's not just a matter of, from Unilever's perspective, they found a whole new market to target and to sell to. But from the impact that this has created for the average person in India, I think, this only goes to show how the mission that we have at Project Pyramid, these are the kind of things that we are trying to look at and to figure out what we can do to in the long run, at least, come up with solutions. So I think that's what I had. And the idea here is, from a business school perspective, we want to come up with ways to create an impact. And one piece of Project Pyramid is this notion of having a sustainable solution, and we have created a consulting arm that actually goes out and resource projects that we can work on both at the local level and on the international level, where we provide what we learn at business school, our MBA students, along with the collaboration from the various schools here at Vanderbilt, to figure out better ways for us to come up with solutions. So as part of that, this year we are taking a trip to Bangladesh, and we are going to be working with Grameen Bank and with a number of other non-governmental organizations in Bangladesh, where we will be looking at not just microfinance, but looking at businesses in the way they work with the supply chain, from a marketing perspective, from an operations perspective, and their impact on issues such as healthcare. So, and we're glad that we have about 7 Vivanti School students coming with us on the trip, along with students from the law school, the Peabody School, and other graduate programs at Vanderbilt. We're looking forward to continued collaboration with the DIP School, and I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. So, thank you.
As you can probably tell as we're going over, that there's been a lot of interest around Project Pyramid. Caring about the poor isn't new to the Divinity School. Jesus did it, a few other people did it in the past, but there's been so much energy right now around poverty alleviation, and particularly about collaborating, working with other schools. Poverty is a huge issue, and we recognize that one person's not gonna have the capacity to solve it on their own. But hopefully, by leaning on these different disciplines and by working together, we'll better be able to address these issues that are at hand. We just wanted to talk to you really briefly about this growing interest and what we've done with it. After being in the business school and seeing different business approaches to alleviating poverty, it also gave a lot of us a heightened understanding of what does the Bible have to say about this? What does our own discipline, how can that inform us in our own work? And so we, as a group of students, several others could be here too to talk to you about this. We approached our deans, we approached faculty, and we got some things rolling. As a group, we met weekly last year just to talk about how could we see this, how could we move forward on this. And one of the things that we did was we approached Dr. Doug Meeks, and we asked him if he would start a class for us. And Lindsay's going to give you just a minute brief about that, and then we'll be closing.
The class we asked Dr. Meeks to teach was called God, Economy, and Poverty. We had a great response of people involved in the class from the law school, business school, Peabody, and Divinity School. We had over 60 students participate and found such a rich experience in the interdisciplinary collaboration. Dr. Meeks invited his working group from the Center for Religion and Culture to lecture, and we got a great model from their interdisciplinary approach. In fact, they've even decided to write a book about that experience. And so we really just enjoyed that collaboration with other schools, the different perspectives, the different insights that everybody brought to the table. We really want to continue to work together in interdisciplinary classes.
So thank you for listening to us, and we hope that you'll continue to just, there's the Project Pyramid website that we'll be updating, continuing to update. And we'd love for you, just any support or thoughts about that. We're continuing to move forward and excited about the prospects.
Our time is up. I wished I hadn't spoken at all so you could have heard more fully from our students. But if you have any questions that you want to put to them or to me, we can take a few questions for a few minutes. And if you have to leave, we won't be insulted. Yes?
I was wondering about how, not so much in India or as we're going to be going to Bangladesh, but here in Nashville, for example, if the topic of homelessness was discussed in your class or in the class that you all have started using.
We spent an entire day in the class where a group of people from the Homeless Powerless Project came to class as a panel and shared their experiences. And a number of us are involved in those issues in Nashville and want to continue to engage it locally in our context. And we appreciate you bringing that up because that was one of the real critiques that we had or real desires that we had during the class, particularly over at Owen, was that's great, we want to be involved globally, but gosh, we don't have to go but 10 steps this way to see it right in our backyard. And I think the complexities of poverty are different in the United States and definitely need our time and energy. And we are hoping to do that. In fact, this semester, while some are going to Bangladesh, we're working on getting a trip to go to Tupelo, which I don't know if you've known much about Tupelo, but it's a city that businesses have come in and the poverty level has really decreased there. So that we can see how is this working on our land as well. Because clearly loving our neighbor isn't just the foreign one. Thank you.
Is there any possibilities that the microloan would be put into Nashville with targeted groups?
I can't answer that necessarily right in Nashville, but I know that they've tried microlending in the United States and that we haven't had the same success rates. For one, you know, getting an ox and getting milk and selling your milk in India might cost $50. But if you get a $50 loan here, really, what are your abilities to really move yourself set anywhere? So there, it seems that not only looking at how microloans have worked outside, but just even practically looking at the amount of money that would entail it's just a different piece. So I don't think that we'll be seeing the same type of results in that way.
Micro means a different thing, adjusted for scale here, but right now the problem is significant.
Yes.
Ryan, can you address that at all? Ryan's one of the business students and one of the leaders in this year's class, and presented last class on microfinancing. So.
There are some micro, some approval programs, if you will. One of the other aspects, in addition to what Joseph was saying, is that one of the things that makes microlending in developing countries work so well is the social fabric that exists, and the fact that it really is a community that wants that in their community. And so some of those, that social fabric does not necessarily exist in the same way that it exists. And so while there are some programs that look at developing entrepreneurs in poor neighborhoods in a lot of cities around the country, it's lacking some of the same similarities. So it does exist, but in a little bit different iteration than overseas.
Thank you. Yes, at the back.
Yes. How do you balance? I was wondering in the class. But how do you balance alleviating poverty with environmental concerns about global warming?
Is that our next class? That's a good question, and one that actually came up in our class. I think Ryan wants to jump in, so I'll let him.
There's been a lot of studies in a lot of cultures around the world. They use very inefficient fuels to do their daily cooking, to heat or to provide energy to them. And so there's a lot of actual opportunities to provide much cleaner, better fuels to them that not only help the environment, but also don't fill their houses with smoke and don't cause health problems. So there's a lot of things like that where you can actually go hand in hand with sustainable, both economically, environmentally, solutions.
But it also raises the moral problem too, which is that okay, so now we're gonna be tough on the poor because of all the waste that all the pollution that we provide. Not to say that it's a real issue, but it's a problem. So for example, there's a Tata in India is coming out with a $2,500 car, right? Which could sell a billion. I don't know. It could sell a lot, which would really increase the greenhouse gas emissions, which is a problem. But it's audacious for me to make that critique in some ways, driving the car I drive, being in this society that I'm in. But it's a real problem. But it's a moral problem for me too. Sorry.
I wonder what the thought is about an American company like Monsanto selling sterile seeds to Indian farmers. They may have a better crop yield, and there's pressure to farmers buying that kind of seed because domination of the market. But the Indian farmers that every year have to go back to Monsanto to buy their seeds rather than being independent and producing their own seeds.
And the students want to tackle that one?
I am not familiar with Monsanto and that, but we did look at Monsanto, what they've done in America too with some of the farming and the patents on seeds. And that, it's complex, but yeah, we've been. Thank you for
much. I would say one of the points of this class is it's almost at the level of intervention, which is to say, it's a very applied level of intervention. So I can see that this conversation is one that we need to have. But in this particular class, we're trying to think, given the setup the way it is, and that's worth looking at. But given the setup the way it is, how can we make differences in people's lives? So that's a big, again, to me, a moral question that I hope we teach in ethics. But it would be worth teaching in this class, too. Yes, ma'am.
My question is, first of all, I want to thank you for all that you're doing. I think it's a wonderful thing that you've combined the divinity with the business school. And my concern is empowering the poor with education. Because I personally feel that if we don't teach them to read, how are we going to empower them to have businesses and to find the divinity answers, find answers in their lives if they can't read? So are you thinking about possibly adding education to your mix?
Sharon?
I'm in the class that I just started, but I would say I'm on a project in a small project of human education. There's a school in there, and it targets the women in charge, the population.
similar initiative coming out of campuses elsewhere in the U.S. and the world, and to what extent are you sort of an isolated initiative, or are you networked into other things?
I think, Asif, you want to take that?
So, in answer to your question, this past fall, we held a case competition at the business school, Project Pyramid case competition. We invited schools from various various business schools around the world. We had 35 schools from the United States, Canada, France, Sweden, and a number of places around the world, 200 plus participants taking part in this case competition. So from if you wanted to just look at evidence that other students are actually interested in something like this, I think this shows the evidence right there. We have another organization called Net Impact, which is an organization of MBA students that works on sustainability solutions. And so Net Impact just held its first conference at Vanderbilt. We had 2,000 plus MBA students come to Nashville this past November. So I think that shows that there's a lot of just business school students that are interested. I know that Duke University, Columbia, and then MIT, and I think Stanford, they all have organizations that are very similar to what we're doing here at Project Pyramid. Only the difference with Project Pyramid, I think, that we've taken a different approach with is we've created this collaborative approach with all the other graduate disciplines at Vanderbilt, which I'm not sure the other business schools are doing.
There are a lot of divinity schools that are looking at poverty. When we started kind of looking at, from a divinity perspective, what we could do with Project Pyramid, we kind of researched other schools. And there are a lot that deal with poverty. Union Seminary in New York has a great poverty initiative, and they were just visiting here last week, and we shared information with them. But we found really no one else that we could find that was doing the interdisciplinary work.
I'm going to take one more question. I've gotten the wrap-up sign. So, sir?
Just an observation. The 800-pound gorilla that's not in the room, or the nursing school, the medical school, and things like that, but healthcare is integral to all of this with a lot of your graphs and slides. And from the medical school, I think there's a lot of interest, and I think that's another group that some of your collaborations might have to think about talking to.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. I think that's true, and that goes to my particular job, which is director of the Cal Turner Center, to make relationships across the professional schools. I will say that the Project Pyramid, and correct me if I'm wrong, is at least helping or thinking about interacting with the Shade Tree Clinic as one place in which they can help locally. And the Shade Tree Clinic is a clinic that was started through the medical school here. Thank you very much for coming out this morning. We'll be around if you want to ask us questions, and I hope you have a good day. Thank you.